Hello, my name's Julia Unwin. I'm the Chief Executive of the Joseph Rantrie Foundation. I'm in Glasgow today to talk about the great opportunity Scotland, and particularly this city, Glasgow, now has to do something about poverty. Poverty that's a scar across this country, but which is something you can easily, readily resolve with enough effort and enough people taking part. Thank you for that welcome, and thank you, Carol, for nice words. No pressure, really, from what she's asked me to do today. It is really significant that we're meeting in this monument to Glasgow's resilience, this monument that said we can change this city and this country. And when you're here and you look around, you realise the confidence that is in the bricks and mortar that we're surrounded by today. And I think that's appropriate because Glasgow is and always has been a resilient city. You have done transformational things with your social housing. Really, quite recently, you have managed to change social housing in a way that remains with massive problems, but also sends a very strong message to the rest of the UK about what can be done. You've transformed your physical infrastructure, not least in the East End and the Commonwealth Games. You've demonstrated the potential to create jobs and improve lives via the Glasgow and Clyde Valley City deal, which is Scotland's first. There are emerging signs that your concerted focus on reduction in violence is actually paying off, and there is global interest in that. I was in Australia a couple of years ago being asked about it. I said I knew nothing, referred them to the right people here. And you're home to the Poverty Truth Commission, the first place in the UK which has provided a genuine and profound platform for people in poverty to speak up. And I'm proud that the Joseph Rantrie Foundation has supported that important work and is replicating it across the UK. And of course, you had a historic turnout in your referendum where people, whatever they were voting for change. So you have a history of resilience and of change. For decades, you've shown a way of dealing with the horrors and shocks of deindustrialisation originally and now globalisation. But the figures are, as Carol says, they are some shocking figures about what's happening here. In this time, the Glasgow Centre for Population Health has shone a very bright light on the persistently poorer health that you see in other parts, that you have here than in other parts of Scotland, and indeed compared to your peers in the north of England and other parts of Europe. It does the same looking at regeneration areas, looking at the Grow Well longitudinal studies, offering priceless insights into the dynamics of what's happening in poor neighbourhoods. A clear challenge we now face is to go beyond the data. My organisation, the Joseph Rantrie Foundation, has decades of data published. So has this organisation. Important and vital evidence which we need to track and carry on looking at. But knowledge and evidence are not enough. They're essential, but they're not sufficient. Because the challenges we face, the second half of the second decade of the 21st century, are challenges that call for an entirely new social settlement, a new way of addressing old problems, a new way of focusing on problems we didn't even expect to see, and a new and a better way of engaging the assets and the strengths of the individuals, the communities, and the cities of Scotland. And for that reason, if none alone, this is the best room in which to have this conversation. I'm going to argue, as I have been arguing from Joseph Rantrie Foundation for some time, that we need a new social settlement. My organisation, established 110 years ago now by a prosperous businessman, has set itself the task of understanding what it would take to make the whole of the UK prosperous and poverty-free. Now, there are people who say this is heroic and ridiculous. At this time, after the very worst recession that we've faced for in any of our lifetimes, and I can say that with confidence, nobody here has lived through another recession as deep and as damaging as the one we've been through. At this time when we are facing national austerity, at this time when we may well be facing further economic crisis, is this the right time to talk about a new form of prosperity, a prosperity in which the country can become poverty-free? And I'm going to argue tonight that not only is it the right time, it's the essential time to do it. Because we will never have a return to steady, sustainable, constant prosperity and a return to growth while we report the levels of figures, the numbers that Carol was referring to, that this organisation's referred to, that my organisation has referred to, if those figures stay steady, let alone if they get worse, we will have no return to prosperity. And for that reason, we at the Joseph Rantry Foundation are arguing one simple theory of change. Poverty is real in the UK. Your First Minister agrees that's the case. The Prime Minister in England yesterday even said it was the case. There is real poverty. It causes real harm, and it is not in any way inevitable. We have the solutions, and that's what I want to talk about. The cost of carrying the numbers of people that we carry now in poverty is ruinous for the UK and for Scotland and for Glasgow and for your neighbourhoods. You all know what those costs are. The waste of the skills and talents of people growing up in poverty, never seeing a way out, never able to contribute to a growing economy, is wasteful. And I think that's risky for all of us. It's certainly risky for the current economy. It's desperately risky for the next generation. So if you'll allow me, in pure balance sheet terms, I want to talk about cost, which you always have on a balance sheet, and waste and risk. I also think the levels of poverty are wrong, but they are bad for all of us, and that's the case I want to argue today. Now, why is now a different time? What's changed? There are a number of things that have changed very significantly. Scotland is fully, firmly part of the global economy, a global economy that can bring enormous gains and economic value, but one that also brings you risks and challenges. The economic global shock as the Chinese stock exchange stuttered 5 months ago, and actually is trembling ever since, has been felt across the world. We all now know that changes in Beijing or Shanghai will have an enormous effect on parts of Glasgow in ways that we perhaps didn't understand before. The interconnectedness of our global economy means that whatever we do, we face risk and change in our economy. And the scenes from Europe since last summer, those terrifying, tragic pictures that we continue to see, which left lives extinguished as people flee from Syria and other parts of North Africa, desperate to survive in a world which is fundamentally at odds. They show us, if nothing else, that the world has changed and changed irrevocably. No longer will it be possible to see conflict in one part of the world and observe it a bit dispassionately. International migration is perhaps the defining issue of our time. All geopolitical change affects all of us and profoundly affects the nature of our social settlement. Sudden shocks, reversals, surprises are part of our new open economy. And the challenge of a new settlement is, what sort of settlement do we want in that very open economy? How can we survive those challenges in a way that means the poorest people and places don't pay the highest price? That's the first reason we need a new settlement. This open, interconnected economy brings undoubted gains. The remarkable growth of Skyspanner, Global Whisky, linking Jura and India and China, extraordinary developments that even a decade ago we could not have properly visualised. But the slump in the global price of oil has already had a major effect on the economy here. And only 8 years ago, reliance on banking and finance was revealed to be as much a liability as an asset when things went so badly wrong at RBS and the Bank of Scotland. We can sit around and bemoan modernity and long for an earlier day when everything was simpler. But actually, there are benefits and gains from this sort of modernity and an open economy. Our challenge is to balance them with the losses and shocks. The economy, the global environment is changing, and there is no hiding place. The second massive change is to our demography, our population. It's no coincidence. We're talking about, in a centre for population health, our demography looks very different. The Scottish population is growing slowly, but steadily, reversing decades of decline. It grew by 4.5% in the decade up to the last census, reflecting net inward migration and natural population growth. But contrast that with 20 years ago, when the discussion was about declining population. Populations change and it affects us. You have an ageing population, as does the rest of the UK. The population of those aged over 65 grew in the same period by just over 10%. But in the cities, we see a very different story. Glasgow has stopped losing people. Its population grew, though by a slower rate of just over 2.5%. And of course, we've got the rapid growth of what we traditionally call people of working age. I don't know about you, but as the age of retirement vanishes over the horizon, I do wonder if we're going to have a different terminology. But Glasgow is attracting students and migrants, and yet at the same time seeing a significant drop in the numbers of older people. That all represents demographic change that's hard to capture. We need the evidence to know it, but we need to recognise what it means, because it will mean different things for different parts of our economy. And more of us are living alone. 43% of this city's households are recorded as single adult in 2011. And my guess is, knowing the figures for the rest of the country, that's probably closer to half now. That figure will be going up. 4 out of 10 in 2011 of your households were single adults. That's a big change to your demography. And of course, the number of people in Scotland coming from an ethnic minority group has grown substantially, especially in Glasgow, where about 1 in 6 of the citizens are from an ethnic minority. There used to be an alibi, never in my view a very justifiable alibi, to say we can't change and adapt our public services because the numbers are so low. That is no longer the case. That alibi has gone. Glasgow now looks much more like many, many other UK cities. So that's just a sprinkling of demographic changes. And there are two responses we can make to them, just as there are to the changing economy. We can mourn the passing of an earlier time. We can get nostalgic. We can look back fondly on more stable communities, stricter than social norms, more homogenous, more class-based communities. And many of us do. Or we can recognise that these changes have brought emancipation, untold freedoms, introduced diversity and difference, and enabled much higher levels of self-expression. Whichever way you go on that, a social settlement that ignores the changing shape of family and community life is simply not worthy of the name. A strong new social settlement needs to ensure that demographic change, whether you see it as a gain or a loss, doesn't further disadvantage those who have the least. Just like global economic change, which brings both benefits and risks, demographic change brings both opportunity and insecurity. I think we need to adapt to both. And the third big area of change, the digital revolution, has changed everything, but also brings massive opportunity. We forget, don't we, how reliant we now are on things that we didn't even know existed 5 years ago. I sometimes recall my grandmother, who was not a stupid woman, saying to me when I was very young, "Do you know, Julia, I think by the time you're grown up, there'll be a computer in every town." I'm pretty grown up now, but there's a computer in every pocket in this room, I guarantee. The speed of adoption and the way in which we've changed was unthought of by the gentleman looking down at us from here. And the pace of that change, the way in which it has speeded up exponentially, is something that has changed our environment, I think, fundamentally. The ability to amass and manage data, making us all apparent experts in analytics, however little we really understand it, has introduced a whole new level of scientific management to social policy. The connectedness, ability for the voiceless to get a voice, the ability to become content creators of our own through social media, the interconnectedness and ability to work across borders, whether they're geographic, economic, emotional, conceptual, all of that provides huge potential benefit, which I think we are only at the foothills of beginning to understand. But the atomization of lives, the risks to privacy, the connectedness between those who wish to wreak havoc, especially in the lives of the most vulnerable, those create profound risks too. The goal of all social policy, it seems to me everywhere, has to be to balance those benefits that I've talked about and the risks, the opportunity and the vulnerability, and to do so in a way that offers protection without disenfranchising, security without stifling, without creating so many casualties. The call for a new social settlement for Scotland is a response to this challenge. And the fourth big area of change, and the one we cannot ignore, although too often we do ignore it at our peril, is climate change. Last month in Paris, it looked as we might just have tipped the global community away from what seemed like a really catastrophic outcome. It made it possible to imagine that we might be able to salvage something from what looks like such a disaster. And many of us will be hugely sceptical about the ability and commitment of countries to come together on these issues, and wonder if the contributions we are asked and called on to make in our homes, in our neighbourhoods, can ever possibly make a difference. But Scotland is leading the way in targets on carbon reduction, and this suggests otherwise. Impressive progress on renewable electricity generation now needs to be matched with energy efficient homes, cleaner forms of transport, all reducing demand. In recent days and weeks, flooding in the Scottish Borders, where JRF has been supporting a study on community resilience to climate change, how appropriate is that, and on Perthshire, Aberdeenshire, Dumfries, Galloway and Moray, underlines the necessity of adapting to more frequent climate risks and mitigating the damage. I live and work in York and run social housing in York. That's where Joseph Rowntree Foundation is based. There was no way in the days between Christmas and New Year that you couldn't take very realistic stock as you put your Wellington boots on and went to visit people whose homes were flooded, of the very extreme ways in which climate change bites on the poorest. To meet people who are living in homes that are uninsurable and that they couldn't afford to insure anyway tells you something about the overlap between extreme disadvantage and poverty and paying the price of climate change. There is no way we can have this discussion about a new social settlement without recognising that climate change, disadvantage and poverty are inextricably linked. But to come to Scotland, I've talked about the big global changes. We at Joseph Rowntree Foundation describe ourselves as the place to get the facts about poverty, about social exclusion, about social change. And every 2 years we publish an independent audit, not of our own figures, but of publicly available figures, how Scotland is faring on a range of poverty and exclusion measures. And we did this most recently in March. And we found, I don't think anyone here will be surprised to hear, a mixed picture. Poverty fell for all age groups in the decade up to 2013, a huge success, by around a third for children and half for the over 65s. It fell for everyone but one group, and a group who I think we're going to have to pay massive attention to in the very immediate term. The number of young adults under 30 in poverty rose to more than 200,000 in Scotland in that period. Trends in the job market, housing and education pose very stark questions of how we can have better, more secure pathways for those young people who are the adults and the wealth creators of the next generation. And while the remarkable drop in poverty for older people across the UK, but in Scotland specifically, underlines very clearly and indeed proves that we can, when we put our minds to it, do things, we can reverse the historic link between poverty and old age. When I was growing up, the picture of old age was an old lady sitting with a shawl by the fire. Poverty and old age were synonymous. We've broken that link. That's a huge social policy success, and you've done it here too. But it looks like a goal, an achievement that could be imperiled very rapidly. The growth of self-employment, frequently precarious, the rate of very low pay in middle age and later on in life, the fact that a very significant percentage of people living below the living wage are in their 40s and their 50s, suggests that we may lose that great social gain of which we could be so proud, that older people are no longer necessarily in deep poverty. We published some work today which makes it very clear that across the UK, people in their 30s, 40s and 50s are by no means saving towards the sort of retirement many of them had hoped for. So the face of poverty has changed. There's always been poverty in Scotland, and for more than a century, higher rates of poverty in this very city. The poverty described by the late Scottish novelist William McIlvany, I've read him but I can't say it, can still be found in streets and neighbourhoods which have all but been bypassed in the modern economy. But that picture of poverty takes its place along the new face of poverty, the new face which is under 40, poorly paid, with very few prospects, and increasingly privately renting expensive, poor quality, short-term housing. Our definition of poverty is that people are poor when they lack the material resources to participate and lead full lives. And today, it is just as likely that a family living in poverty will include adults who are going out to work. Low pay, irregular hours, short-term contracts, and unreliable work are the challenges facing modern families who are poor. And what is more, poor people are now very much more likely to be disabled, experience poor mental health, or a long-term health condition. Poverty is closely associated with disability, and at a time when, for very good reasons, we should be celebrating the fact that there are a much higher percentage of people with disabilities and long-term medical conditions in our population, more and more of them are poor. Poverty looks different, and we will require different responses, a different narrative, and a different set of solutions. The number of Scottish households in poverty is now spread evenly by tenure. It's fallen substantially in the social rented sector, as you might have expected, as average rents have been maintained at an affordable level and pensioners are a much larger share of tenants. But it still affects more than 350,000 social tenants, a significant number of people whose landlords are themselves determined to do something about poverty. It's fallen more gradually among owners, but nearly as many owners struggle to afford the upkeep on their homes because of poverty, another 300,000. And in the private rented sector, which is going like a train south of the border, I can tell you, it's doubled in Scotland in the last decade, although from a very low base. But the number of people living in poverty has doubled to more than 250,000. This growing risk is faced predominantly by younger households with fewer choices, with average rents accounting for a rising share of income. The sector accounts also for a disproportionate share of households below tolerable standard and half of all calls to Shelter Scotland hotline. So housing and the nature of the labour market are creating a different picture of poverty, one which has familiar features and new features too. But we would also say that people who are poor face much higher costs. The five-year inflation rate has been higher for poorer households. The bottom 10% of the country, in terms of spending, face an average annual price increase of 3.7%, according to the ONS, compared with 2.3% for the top 10%. It's quite a significant difference. The bottom 10% have that much higher rate of inflation. We've even discussed whether we should have a poverty rate of inflation. It is so much higher, as I'm sure most of you will recognise, because the largest part of the budget for poorer households goes on all those costs, which we all know have risen so rapidly, on heating, on housing, on food, on childcare, on the cost of borrowing. The poor continue to pay more, where internet access is a requirement for anyone wanting to control costs. The disabled woman living alone with her children and only able to make it to the corner shop will be facing a far, far higher cost than the car-driving internet surfer, or even a low-income family with easy access to Lidl or Aldi. Faced with this barrage of statistics, it's easy to think this problem is insuperable. We can all put our head in our hands and say there is a dreadful inevitability about poverty. It's always affected the same families and communities, no matter what we do. Those voices are out there, and they are very loud. They're joined by voices which say we can feel terribly sorry for people who, for whatever reason, struggle to make ends meet, but really, it's a problem without resolution. We can say that. Or we can say, just as easily, there is an issue of poverty, it does need to be addressed, but really, it's not a problem of our own making, it's caused mainly by, pick and mix, the UK government's approach to welfare reform, yes, probably, or it's caused by the additional costs of goods and services due to EU regulation, possibly, or it's caused by poor people themselves failing to take advantage, possibly. It could be any of those. I'm arguing tonight there are real dangers in placing responsibility with them instead of us, allowing this to be the prism through which we think about, talk about, seek to act upon poverty, with or without the collusion of the media and all the other voices shouting in our ears, holds us back from a powerful, inclusive response. And it makes the prospect of a sustainable economy vanishingly hard to realise. A practical, costed, carefully developed plan rooted in sound evidence and in experience can end poverty in Scotland. And the players in this endeavour are many of them in this room, or indeed not very far from here. We don't need to ask permission from anyone to start work on ending poverty. I want to use the three P's of the Scottish Child Poverty Strategy to sketch out how such a plan could be shaped. I use them quite shamelessly because Joseph Rowntree Foundation's own strategy has just stolen those three P's because we think they're a clever way of looking at, but we've added a fourth of prevention. We know only too well the gulf between the vision, as you set out by the Christie Commission, and the difficulty of aligning plans and resources. We are not naive, but we do know that if we don't face this challenge, even in the face of major reductions, which obviously we're all facing, we will never get to the stability and security that the next generation require of us. If our organising purpose is to reduce the numbers of people in poverty, if we are deadly serious about that being our organising purpose, we can succeed. And the first P is about the pockets. The pockets of people who are poor are empty. And they're empty, obviously, self-evidently, because of what's going in to those pockets and also what's going out. In terms of income, of course, wages matter. Hugely welcome that the UK government has recognised the need to raise the minimum wage, even if it's done it in a way that some of us think is a bit careless, done on a timescale in a way that's caused other problems. But at least there's a recognition, finally, that a basic level of income matters, even if only those over 25 who are so recognised. Scotland is further ahead on extending what I would like to call the real living wage, the voluntary living wage. Working with employers and supported by the Scottish Government, the Poverty Alliance is progressing towards having 500 accredited living wage employers by March. The need for leadership is really clear here. One in five of the Scottish workforce, 440,000 people, still earning less than the living wage. That means earning less than all our research says you need to lead a decent, sustainable way of life. It's the second lowest rate in the UK, but I wouldn't celebrate too much. It's a number that's still rising. Households with only part-time jobs, women, of course, women leading these households, young people, and those in rural areas are most affected. But fair work is not just about wages, and pockets are not just about wages. An hourly rate that allows a life above subsistence is fine if that work is regular, full-time, guaranteed. If it's sporadic, temporary, and unreliable, it does little to fill those empty pockets. A volatile global economy means that sporadic work with little protection is likely to grow rather than diminish. So we need an economic strategy that addresses the need for secure employment and a social settlement that recognises temporary instability to make sure that this volatile economy doesn't extract an impossible price from poorer households while providing ever greater opportunity and wealth for the better off. Pressure on incomes has undoubtedly been eased by some of the profoundly right choices made here. The Scottish Welfare Fund, the expansion of discretionary housing payments, have reduced the risk of some of the more severe poverty we've seen in the rest of the UK. And of course, extra funding for debt and money advice is one of the most effective ways of helping families take control of their finances. But costs, the money going out of pockets, matters too. It's 40 years since the seminal work, The Poor Pay More, was published. But if anything, this issue has only become more acute. There are costs of access. The public panels convened by JRF to determine the minimum income standard say that having a car is essential if you want to drive down household costs. Shopping only from a corner shop in the local food deserts in which so many poor people are trapped increases costs, reduces quality. Access to the internet is really regarded as essential. For so many of us, it's become a giant cost comparison toolkit. A lack of access to transport, the internet, and forms of banking which offer appropriate control all add to costs. But so too does charging. Every system of charging that privileges those of us who can pay in advance or by direct debit brings advantages to the better off and penalises those who pay their bills in cash or top up a card to pay for their electricity. And of course there are the very evident commercial costs that bite most heavily upon the poorest. Walk into Bright House, anywhere in the country. Walk into Bright House and see the brilliant offers. A hot pint washing machine just cost £8 a week, but you'll pay it for 3 years, adding up to £1,248. Go online, price comparison website, and you have it delivered free for £429 from Currys, if you've got £429. Or the cheapest, nice-looking three-seat sofa for £11 a week, coming to £1,716 after 3 years. All displayed very beautifully. Incredibly attractive. I recommend it to anyone to go and have a look, offering eye-watering costs, instant reward, and a trapdoor into catastrophic debt. Public policy influences how much flows through pockets, But not just public policy alone. And this is where I want to start talking about the other actors. We look too often for public policy alone. Employers and businesses design their HR management systems. Employers who recognise that offering a guarantee of stability and security may create a modest financial cost to their business, but will be repaid in loyalty, commitment, and the great 21st century prize of engagement. Employers who switch from temporary contracts during the downturn back to permanent contracts as business picks up. Businesses that screen their marketing policies to understand how they bite hardest on the poorest customers and do something about it. Companies which can see the potential in providing low-cost, genuinely low-cost products tailored to customer needs without adding unfair costs. They have a part to play, and so do does community action and civic engagement through voluntary organisations, faith groups, trade unions. For every joint buying scheme in Scotland, every collective switching energy initiative, every alternative lending scheme, every charity shop challenging its commercial rivals, each in its own way makes a tangible contribution to the pockets of people living in poverty. And so does the web of informal help and support. The first recourse to anyone in difficulty is always their families and neighbours. Nobody ever goes first to a homeless person's unit when they are in trouble. The community and neighbours are the first front line of support. And the subject of our recent Livable Lives study in the contrasting areas of Maryhill, Hillhead and Bearsden all showed the importance of that web of informal help and support. All of that helps and changes the pockets of people in poverty. But it's not just the money coming in and the money going out. We're also concerned about the prospects. The killer statistic, the only one I've rehearsed that I always remember and will rehearse everywhere I go, is that 4 out of 5 people going from unemployment into poorly paid work are still low paid 10 years later. I don't know about you, I've worked in this field a very long time, but until I saw that figure, 4 out of 5, I think I had assumed that for many people, poor pay was a stage in life. And I could look around me and my friends and my family and I guess most of this room and think, we've all done that for a bit. Low pay that you are receiving in your 30s, 40s and 50s means that when your family washing machine breaks down, you face a catastrophe. When your children's feet grow, you face a disaster. And when you come to think about retirement, all you have got is a lot of debt. So prospects matter. A poorly paid job when you're 18, which is still poorly paid when you're 25, 30 and 40. Just as work is frequently unreliable, meaning people may move in and out of work but never out of poverty, so too people are trapped in poverty while working, just as surely as others are trapped on benefits. The food banks, the Trussell Trust, report the increasingly high percentage of people using food banks who are working. I've described this as a fundamental breach of the social contract. To go out to work and to be unable to provide the basics for your family seems to me to be a breach of what our expectation is as society. And this is not job snobbery or a lack of recognition of the need for productivity. The whole of the UK suffers a massive productivity conundrum, and we need policies to address it. The productivity problem, however, appears to be greater still in exactly those low-paid sectors of the economy which are expanding and which are the pillars of our recovery. Retail, hospitality, the care economy are the sectors in which low pay is locked in, and yet they are the sectors without which we will have no recovery at all. If we only pursue economic growth without thinking of the people cleaning the offices at 5 a.m, the wealth creators just as much as the tycoon whose office is cleaned, cooking burgers at midnight, caring for us as we age, that growth is both unsafe and inevitably short-term. The infrastructure of our recovery risks locking low pay and poverty and vanishingly low prospects into that recovery, and that recovery will fail. Because in those three sectors alone, you will find half of all the low-paid workers in Scotland. And those workers face very limited prospects. So low pay is a problem, but we associate it with progression and the nature of work. Evidence we published last year showed that those working below the living wage or part-time or with few qualifications are the least likely of all to access in-work training. In other words, if you're poor, you are likely to stay poor. In Scotland, where the housing market, employment and wage levels have been relatively less volatile, This is the time to set that clear purpose and ensure that growth, economic growth, does bring everyone with it, that we don't face a social recession while we recover from the past economic recession. And I'm arguing that businesses can play their part too, structuring their workforces in ways that recognise skills and experience, reward engagement, and provide scope for progression. It is no accident that the sectors in which low pay is locked in are the sectors where it is the human relationship that matters. These are not jobs that are offshored. Waitress jobs and care jobs are not automated. They're the jobs where we expect a human relationship, and yet our models of productivity reward speed rather than relationship. Businesses across the country are engaging with this. In all of this, Scotland's story is mixed. You've shown fantastic sustained progress through modern apprenticeships, setting a course which others in the UK could follow, but with outcomes still worryingly segregated by gender and ethnicity. And you have provided access to in-work training for all. The City Deal in this region is an opportunity, and I think first job opportunities, apprenticeships are all significant. But I can't leave the question of prospects without talking about childcare, about which this government and local authorities have done so much. The prospects of women and increasingly men in the workforce will never brighten without really high-quality childcare. All of us in this room who've ever left a young child to be cared for by others know that no one will leave their child willingly somewhere that's inadequate. And yet, our patchy provision, underskilled and low-paid workforce, and frankly chaotic mix of funding streams mean that children's development isn't maximised, and the prospects of those people with caring responsibilities, those pillars of the caring economy, are persistently damaged. The evidence is uncontrovertible. Good quality and affordable childcare of the right sort doesn't just help parents to progress, it improves the prospects of the next generation too. And the final P is for place. The neighbourhoods we come from, the homes we live in, the schools we go to, these all shape us and our future lives. But they can also be places that lock in poverty, that make progression hard, that are corrosive of aspiration. If the places we live in offer us a secure start, they can be places where we can contribute as well as benefit, where, as the great sustainability campaigners say, we will want to stay for a while. And yet too often the places where poor people live have few of these characteristics. Walk down a main street anywhere, and I defy you not to know the incomes of the people living in that area. Go to one street, admire the wine bars, coffee shops, interesting restaurants, even maybe a bookshop. Go to another and see the cheap off sales, expensive finance, betting shops, unhealthy fast food. As planners, developers, and as stewards, we send a signal through the places we design and sustain. This isn't just the market responding to need and demand. This is a process of licensing, public investment, and permission that means that poorer areas feel different. These poorer postcodes are then shunned by employers, some retailers, and financial services. People who make decisions about them rarely live there and certainly don't send their children to school there. If it isn't good enough for us, it shouldn't be good enough for everyone else. And of course, houses are rooted in places. If our housing on offer is overcrowded, damp or unsafe, if it's short-term and insecure, if it's expensive and dilapidated, it sends a message to those living there. Our greatest triumph as a society has been that we've broken the historic link between poverty and squalor, just as we've broken the link between poverty and later life. The work of councils, housing associations across the UK, like the Wheatley Group here on large scale and small in many neighbourhoods, and the Scottish Government, mean that poor people can expect to live in decent, dry, secure homes. Can't in England at the moment with the housing bill going through, but in Scotland you can still hang on to that. This great gain is imperiled if social housing developments stall and poor quality landlords become again a fixture in our lives. The current private tenancies bill, combined with broad consensus on the need to increase affordable housing supply, forms a necessary, but again, not yet sufficient response. So, prospects, pockets, places. Scotland has a clear and stated commitment in principle to extending social justice and tackling poverty. I think it's now got an opportunity to signal something quite different, which will show the way in the UK, but also in Europe. You can signal in this country and indeed in this city. In this country, in this city, if ill health, bad luck, low pay, Divorce, or frankly, poor decisions make you poor, and they may well do for most of us at some stage. We in this city, in this country, know how to intervene to make sure that experience is brief and doesn't scar the next generation. Bad things happen. Good societies can help people get out of them. In Scotland, it could be that you could signal. Employers ensure that people are trained for the jobs not of yesterday, but of tomorrow. And that know by offering fair work, they're also building a strong, resilient economy. It's the second thing you could do. In Scotland, you could say, we know we're subject to global shocks and changes. We're ready for them. We know how to ensure the poorest people and places don't pay a high price for change. We have the systems ready to deal with the shocks that are inevitable. In Scotland, you can say, we have public and private services that mean people, even on low incomes, can live decently and in community with others. And in Scotland, the next generation could be made able to contribute and support both the community and the economy, regardless of the income of their parents. At the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, we're focusing our resource on mapping out what's needed for Scotland and the whole of the UK to be prosperous and free of poverty. We know the path is incredibly complicated. We know that we'll only achieve lasting change if all of us focus on poverty reduction as part of our organising purpose. But we also know that the prize is great. A stronger, more resilient city and country will only be possible if we have a just settlement that means that poverty no longer scars this place. The title of my talk was Why Fight Poverty? I think we need to fight poverty because it's real, because it causes immense harm to all of us, and because it can be solved. Thank you.